Blog Talk Radio.
This is JJ Bomber. You are listening to Well Armed Radio.
Well, good evening, sheepdogs. Welcome to Well Armed Radio, where freedom is our best friend. Thank you for joining us in our weekly, vigorous, well, again, check that, semi-weekly, tri-weekly. Thank you for joining us in our tri-weekly, vigorous, relentless, and on occasion, ruthless pursuit of freedom. We are broadcasting live from the exceptionally well-armed studio in New Berlin, Wisconsin. It's my pleasure to speak to the most informed gun owners in the state. That would be you guys. You are your community's finest. With a face for radio and a voice for silent movies, my name is Nick Clark. I'm the president of Wisconsin Carry and the host of Well Armed Radio, and encourage you to be a part of the show with your calls, ideas, questions, comments, criticism, participation. If you so choose, phone number for the show, 563-999-3787, 563-999-3787. Start the show with the usual warning here, no sacred cows. And first thing we'll touch base with today is a little recap of the Wisconsin Carry annual meeting, which took place at the world's largest Culver's in Edgerton, Wisconsin. Got to see some Wisconsin Carry members today, some familiar faces, a couple new faces, and it was great to get back to some of our face-to-face discussion/meeting/all that good stuff. So it was great to see the guys up there, guys and gals that made it to the meeting. So I'll give you a quick recap of that. And some other things we're going to talk about today was we'll talk about the Wisconsin governor's race, talk about ghost guns, talk about a few other little topics here if I get time. My daughter's doing an essay for one of her classes, and it's, you hear about it. You hear about the indoctrination of public schools and public universities, and then when you get to see it firsthand, it's a little more, what's the word I'm looking for? It's a little more disturbing because you know it's there, but then when you actually see it for yourself, again, it's just a bit more disturbing. So that's what we're gonna have up in the show here tonight, and then anything else we might end up getting to. So to start, we had the Wisconsin Carry annual meeting today. And maybe before that, I'll give you guys a quick apology. So I've been off for what I think the last show we had was the first, I think it was April. Was it April 3rd? I think that was the last show we had was April 3rd. If not, then it would have been March. But so I've been off for a couple weeks, and what I, 1 week I just, I was going to do every other week. And then last week we ended up going to kind of a spur of the moment trip to Door County, up to Washington Island, and then headed over to Rock Island, had quite the adventure up there, spectacular time, but again, turned into quite the adventure. And then just to be honest, shoot it straight up to you guys. I've been a little bummed out. Now it's probably a month ago. If you've listened to the show before, you've heard me say when I say many years ago, probably it's probably 2017. I want to say it was like June of 2017, first time this ever happened to me. But I had was out of my boat all day, hot day, drinking in the sun, drank a lot, didn't hydrate, whatever, got pretty dehydrated, woke up early in the morning. And I just could tell that my heartbeat was irregular. So I wake my fiance up and I say, hey, feel my pulse. My heartbeat's regular. She's like, oh, she goes, my fiance was an ER nurse. She was an ER nurse for 20 some years. And then she's still a registered nurse, but she works in a ambulatory service center, surgery center now, a little more controlled pace from the high stress of the ER. But anyway, so she's like, I think you're in AFib, atrial fibrillation. I was like, oh, what the fuck? So go to the urgent care the next day just to get checked out. And they said, oh, what were you doing the day before? I said, oh, I was on my boat drinking. Anyway, so it's called holiday heart. And it's some people, you can get a heart arrhythmia if you're dehydrated. And one of the things that dehydrates you is alcohol. So you can Google it. It's called holiday heart. And it's just something that pops up. Like there's people who tend to get atrial fibrillation after. They call it holiday heart because people that on a holiday, they're with family, maybe drinking more than they usually do. And an episode of quote binge drinking will trigger atrial fibrillation. It lasts for probably 8 to 12 hours after I get it. So if it usually happens, I wake up in the early morning, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 in the morning. And it lasts probably till the next day, 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon. So yeah, about 12 hours. Being young, atrial fibrillation, the big risk, it's not like it's a perfusing rhythm, they say. So it's not something that you're at risk for, what's the word I'm looking for? Not something that you're at risk for, like a heart attack or something, but the risk of atrial fibrillation is that it can trigger, you can get a stroke, because the blood kind of pools up in the atrium. And then when it pools up there, you end up with, that's where you can get a blood clot, and that can lead to a stroke. Speaking of which, I have to apologize. I'm going to give you a couple seconds of music here because I got to run and grab something real quick that I forgot. Not an emergency, but I gotta do something. Okay, so back with you. Apologize. That's some really, really crappy podcast broadcast there. But again, not an emergency, but something I forgot to do and had to take care of that real quick. So anyway, so long story short, you know, nobody wants to hear all that. I get this holiday hard thing. Happened that one time. So then I'd cut back how much I drank on Saturdays. I mean, I don't drink at all. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Oh, excuse me. Sunday through Thursday, don't drink a drop. Drink a little bit Friday evening, and then Saturday afternoons is my day where I, you know, chill out and, you know, drink all afternoon and through the evening. So anyway, so that's first time it happened was June 2017. Went just, to, I think, a little over 2 years, and then it happened again. And so and it's the kind of thing that gets to be a little bit more bothersome as you get older. I'm 47 now. But anyway, long story short, so I had it happen a couple weeks ago, and it just, every time it happens, it bums me out. And then I was at a trade show, and it happened in the middle of the day, and I've never had atrial fibrillation during the middle of the day. So anyway, it's just had me stressed out and worried, and I tend to be a bit of a hypochondriac, and so I just wasn't in the mood to do a show and didn't want to do a show, and it was a bummer. And so anyway, so I'm there's plenty of things you can do for atrial fibrillation. Like you can get something, this procedure is called an ablation. A friend of mine had it. He's like, hey, Nick, I know how you like to worry. Your AFib thing, he goes, I used to have it and it wasn't from drinking. It was like, if he drank too much coffee, he would get atrial fibrillation. And he's like, so, you know, you go and you get an ablation. He's like, and it just works wonders. You almost never have an episode after that. And so I talked to the cardiologist and they're like, yeah, it's a pretty effective procedure for 85% of the people that get it. And they say, you know, for a good 10, 15 years, you won't have any issues with atrial fibrillation at all. So I'm like, okay. So it's something that I, you know, if it becomes a problem, I can, you know, get this procedure done. But it's just, anyway, so that's been bugging me, and I didn't want to do a show when I was in a bad mood, and I just tend to obsess and be a bit of a hypochondriac. So another reason why I haven't been doing a podcast the last couple of weeks, combined with I didn't have some striking subjects to talk about. So anyway, here we are 3 weeks later, and we've got another podcast that we're doing tonight. So again, anybody who's tuning in, great to have you guys tuned in and catching up with the show. So annual meeting took place today. Again, great to see some familiar faces. And it was up at the world's largest Culver's. Started at noon. I actually made it there a few minutes early. Usually I'm running a couple minutes late for the annual meeting. But I got there a few minutes early. And then I'd say when I got there, there was maybe 15, 20 people. And then around noon, right at noon, a few more straggled in. And then I think that's a Wisconsin Kerry thing, or maybe I set bad precedent because I'm always running a few minutes late for the annual meeting. But I would say probably 12, 15, everybody's there. I think we might have had 30, you know, maybe 30 people by the time it was all said and done. So, you know, great group of guys, some familiar faces, some new faces, and a little less than typical. I mean, prior to COVID, I'd say we'd probably average about 50, you know, maybe 50 people for an annual meeting. Our best ever was probably closer to 200, 250. That was our second annual meeting, which was at the Dry Bean Saloon in Fitchburg in 2011, spring of 2011, just before the concealed carry law was passed. So everybody was super engaged, super interested then. But anyway, so great to catch those people. I just gave a summary of what's been going on. The Wisconsin Carry mailing went out last week. So if you're a Wisconsin Carry member and you didn't get your mailing, let me know if you've moved, if your address is out of date if your address is out of date on our records, that might be one reason. So if you still have forwarding service, you might get that in the next week or so. If it's beyond the forwarding time, then it gets bounced back to me, and then I will process those as the, you know, throughout the off season here, we process those and try to get our address list as current as we possibly can. So one of the things we do at the annual meeting is discuss the litigation that Wisconsin Carry has. It's really the 4-point methodology that we have: the litigation, grassroots legislative activism, public relations and media outreach, and then education. Those are our four tactics. Most of the things we do fall under those things. So, and I guess, you know, I'd even throw, pretty much everything we do falls into one of those categories. So I summarize each of those. And the one that usually takes the most time is litigation. The cases that we've had this year, the first and I think most impactful was the Dubik case, which was in front of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. I think I've gone through that on the show before, so maybe I won't go into detail. But essentially, the Dubik case is one that will set precedent and establish that in Wisconsin, disorderly conduct can never be a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, even if the domestic violence enhancer is attached to the disorderly conduct citation or disorderly conduct misdemeanor. It can never, based upon how the federal Lautenberg Amendment is written slash structured, in order for something to be domestic violence, there has to be unwanted touching. That's the phrase that they used in the court cases for the Lautenberg Amendment. So there has to be unwanted touching that occurred for domestic violence. So that means shouting is not enough. You can't just shout at someone and have it be domestic violence. There's got to be unwanted touching. That means hitting, striking, pushing, the sexual assault type touching. There's got to be unwanted touching for it to be considered domestic violence under the federal Lautenberg Amendment, which of course the federal Lautenberg Amendment is the amendment that has ensnared many people because, you know, felony conviction, you know, you can't have you lose your gun rights with a felony conviction, but you also lose your gun rights for a misdemeanor conviction if it involved domestic violence. And again, the federal Lautenberg Amendment that made a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence a prohibitive offense, meaning you can't have you lose your gun rights. The qualifications for that was that domestic violence has to involve unwanted touching. Well, in Wisconsin, in order for a statute to fall under the Lautenberg Amendment, well, in Wisconsin, disorderly conduct includes a whole bunch of things, some of which don't involve any touching at all. Boisterous, profane, and otherwise disorderly, I think, is one of the descriptors. And so for that reason, because you can get a conviction for disorderly conduct and not have touched someone unwantingly, again, because some in Wisconsin, some of the things that qualify as domestic violence do not involve unwanted touching. By the federal statute, that means that the whole disorderly conduct statute cannot be a trigger for the Lautenberg Amendment. So even though some aspects of disorderly conduct could involve physical contact violence, because it's possible to be convicted of disorderly conduct where there was no unwanted touching, there was no physical contact, that means that statute doesn't apply under Lautenberg. And that's what Wisconsin Attorney General Josh Call was applying. And that's how he was revoking licenses from people who had already had them issued. And also that's how he was denying licenses to people who applied. They'd go look at, you know, if you had a misdemeanor conviction of disorderly conduct, they're going through those and pulling police reports and looking to see if they can find any element not even the misdemeanor enhancer on it, but any element of misdemeanor, any element of domestic violence. In the Dubeck case, he never harmed his wife, never hit his wife. His wife said she was never afraid for her safety. What he did do was she locked him out of the house. He used his shoulder and broke in the door, essentially, to get back into the house that his wife had locked him out of. And so because of that, you know, he was given a disorderly conduct citation. But in the police reports, it even says his wife wasn't afraid. She didn't. He never struck her. She wasn't afraid of him hitting her. So anyway, that was what was heard in front of the Supreme Court and what we're awaiting a decision for any day. That was probably the most and people who think, oh, that never doesn't matter to me. That'll never apply to me. And I would say, oh, I beg to differ, because, for example, now domestic violence, anybody that you're in a domestic relationship with. So a domestic relationship could even include boyfriend and girlfriend. So let's say you start dating a girl. And 2 weeks in, you realize she's a crazy bitch and you dump her and she freaks out and flips out. And she knows, calls the police on you and you guys get in an argument and you get charged with disorderly conduct, which is, again, could be just a misdemeanor or a municipal citation. Even I think there's misdemeanor disorderly conduct. I think there's even a municipal citation for disorderly conduct that you can be issued. But if the police report says that, he was screaming at his ex-girlfriend or screaming at his girlfriend, and that's something that could potentially ensnare you as a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. You get charged with disorderly conduct, and there was a domestic element to it. You know, you were screaming at your ex-girlfriend or vice versa. Anyway, so that's why I say to people, you know, you're, but for the grace of God, there go I. I mean, you might think, hey, I'm happily married. You know, I don't have to worry about domestic violence. I think even relatives, I think for example, I know of a case, I've heard of, I couldn't name the individuals anymore, but there was a case where a guy slapped his stepson. And police were called, was charged with disorderly conduct. And again, all he did was slap his stepson. There's people who've gotten in bar fights and been charged with misdemeanor battery. Broke a bottle over someone's head, get charged with misdemeanor battery. And that's okay. You can still get your concealed carry license because that's misdemeanor battery. And then there's people who all they did was slap their stepson in a, argument. And that was constituted a misdemeanor crime of domestic, was charged just with disorderly conduct. And then boom, lost their gun rights because of the triggering the Lautenberg Amendment. Now, again, if we're successful in this case, we will set a precedent to address that. We will have a precedent set whereby disorderly conduct can never be misdemeanor. In Wisconsin, disorderly conduct can never be a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. So a couple other cases, the return of property, the Durzay case, good precedent that we set there. Essentially, prior to that, there's judges in Milwaukee who, if you didn't have receipts for every gun that you owned, if the police seized your guns for whatever reason, and that could even include a car accident. You get in a car accident, you got guns in the car, you got to be transported to the hospital. The police are going to, your car is going to be taken on a wrecker to a junkyard, and the guns are going to be taken from your car. The police take them and take possession of them. And then people have had to go to court to get them back. Again, no crimes, no alleged crimes, just merely being held for safekeeping by the police. People have had to go to court with a return of property petition to get their firearms back. It's ridiculous, but it's the way that Milwaukee works. And then some of the judges were ordering that firearms that you didn't have receipts for would not be returned to you. So if you bought your gun at Gander Mountain, great. Bought your gun at Cabela's, great. Go get a receipt, copy the receipt, proof of ownership. But guns that you were willed, guns that you inherited, no way, no return, because you couldn't prove they were yours. Well, after we took that to court, essentially the ruling was at the Seventh Circuit that if the police seize guns from you, you're property receipt, when police seize property from you, they give you a receipt for the property they seized. Your property receipt is proof of ownership. So guns that you inherited, guns that were private party sale that you don't have receipts for, They're still yours, and the courts have to return them. And that's what we said in Durzay. Then there was a case where we got the T-shirt lawsuits. You guys don't need to hear more about those. You're familiar with those. Kids that wore pro-gun shirts to school. We already won one in Marcus Sand. Though it was won by getting a preliminary injunction from the federal court judge in Milwaukee, not by getting a, not by getting a ruling because it didn't go to trial. But when the preliminary injunction was granted, that's pretty much the judge saying he's probably going to rule in your favor. And then the defendants in that case settled, which agreed to allow the student, it was up in Marcus Sand, agreed to allow the student to wear the T-shirt. So now it's Kettle Moraine High School and a school up in Neenah. We got a different ruling out of the Green Bay District of Federal Court, Eastern District, Wisconsin. There's two Eastern District Federal Courts in Wisconsin, one in Green Bay, one in Milwaukee. And the one in Milwaukee, we had a judge rule in our favor. The one in Green Bay ruled against us. So that's why we appealed to the Seventh Circuit, and we're hopeful for a positive outcome there. Then the next case was the Lafferty case. Foster parents who are prohibited from, by Washington County, prohibited from possessing firearms. I think if they have firearms, they have to be locked in a safe. So the guy is a concealed carry license holder. They want to be foster parents, but essentially the foster system is saying that you can't be a foster parent and exercise your right to carry. You can't be a concealed carry license holder and carry. I think that by their rules, you could do it when the kids weren't around. You could have guns locked in a safe in the home, but you couldn't, for example, be carrying concealed and take the kids out to eat or, you know, go for a walk. That was against the rules that the County Department of Health and Human Services had put in place. So the defendants there are both the county and also the someone at the state Department of Health and Human Services. And we lost at circuit court. And so that has been appealed, and that case is still in briefing. So that one, we're not close to a decision. And then the last case was the case with a woman in West Dallas, Amanda, who was open carrying and was arrested, wasn't doing anything wrong, and harassed, and again, hadn't broken any laws. So we took another one of those cases. So that's a little summary of what we had for litigation. Next thing I was going to talk about tonight was the Wisconsin governor's race. It's real interesting, and it's at the same point I find it a little bit frustrating to tune into talk radio in WISN talk radio here in Wisconsin, Southeast Wisconsin. I think it's some of their shows are syndicated statewide, maybe in Madison as well. But it's for me, it's a little frustrating to tune into when they talk about the Republican primary because. Some of the talk show hosts, I think, come off a bit preachy. I thought Rush Limbaugh handled Republican primaries very, very, very well. And by that, he kind of stayed out of them, didn't take a side in a Republican primary. Certainly, obviously, in the general elections, he did. But didn't take a side in the Republican primaries. Instead, and the most recent example would have been the 2016, when Donald Trump was running for president, having that large field of Republicans, everyone from Jeb Bush to Ted Cruz to John Kasich to Ben Carson to obviously Donald Trump. I think I said Ted Cruz. I'm forgetting who I'm missing. Scott Walker was in that primary field. I'm missing a couple others. I don't think they're going to come to me. Maybe Chris Christie. I think Chris Christie was in the field as well. I can't remember if Rudy Giuliani was in that field to start with as well. But anyway, large field in the Republican primary. But it eventually whittled down to Donald Trump, Ted Cruz, and of course, John Kasich hung in there. But I think it was really Donald Trump and Ted Cruz. And, Rush never really picked a side. And instead, he tried to explain who Donald Trump was. He tried to explain what Trump supporters saw in Donald Trump. And that was really, so he was like, people, I think, some in conservative, and that's why Rush had such a great connection with his audience, because he expressed things that his audience members felt, even though his audience members obviously didn't have the platform that he did, but expressing things his audience members felt, it made his audience members feel connected and their voice heard. That's kind of why they were called ditto heads, because Rush would say something, they'd say ditto. It wasn't that Rush was telling them what to think. It was that Rush was expressing either things that they already thought, but typically didn't hear out in the mainstream news reporting, or Rush was expressing things that they felt, but hadn't quite been able to formulate into cogent statements. So in both cases, it wasn't that Rush was changing people's minds or convincing them of things. And he did some of that. I mean, people would call in and say, hey, I used to be a Democrat, and after listening to your show, I became a conservative Republican. But the big thing that I think what Rush did was he, again, for people who could articulate their conservative thoughts, but they didn't see those conservative thoughts shared in mass media, Rush was the voice of people who said the same things to their friends, to their family, but didn't hear that stuff out in the mainstream mainstream media. And again, I hate to call Rush mainstream media because when we typically think of mainstream media, we think of the liberal networks and things, but out in the mass media. And then the other side of it was sometimes people felt things. Their instincts said, hey, this is what seems right. This is what feels right. But maybe they couldn't quite express it. They knew that they supported closing the borders or something. I'm trying to think of a good example. But they couldn't quite express why that was like the right thing, the moral thing, the conservative thing. But they knew that they had the gut instinct that that was wrong. And Rush could then articulate a more logical, rational explanation for those feelings. So again, some people he was the voice saying what they said, and some people he was the voice saying what those people felt but couldn't quite articulate. But here we have in Milwaukee, the talk radio hosts, it seems to me, are more interested in thinking that they're persuasive, thinking that they're preaching, thinking that they're, again, they wouldn't say that. They wouldn't say that they're preaching, but it comes off like that. You know, they're trying to drive people to a certain conclusion, drive people to a certain candidate, drive people to a – and that's just not the way that Rush Limbaugh handled himself in primaries. I think that endeared him to his audience. People don't like to be told what to do. I mean, we're all grown adults. If you're listening to talk radio, you're probably a grown adult. I mean, certainly maybe there's some 18-year-olds, and we could argue if that's a grown adult. But, you know, most 21 and over, you know, early 20s, mid-20s and older, you're a grown adult. And grown adults don't like being told who to vote for. You know, and there's some that do. I mean, there's some people that just, they want someone else to think for them, and there's some that do. But most people don't like being told what to do. And I think too often talk radio comes across as telling people what to do, even though they'll say, well, we're not telling anyone what to do, but they're pushing their opinion on a candidate in a Republican primary on their audience. And I think that turns a lot of people off, certainly turns me off. But so here we have the, you've got Rebecca Clefish, who's many have called the front runner. I don't know if that really is the case, but certainly maybe the most name recognition amongst Republican circles. Then you've got Kevin Nicholson, who's also running. Then you've got Tim Rantham. And then you've got now Tim Michaels has jumped into the race, who's executive of the Michaels Corporation, one of Wisconsin's largest corporations. So it was rumored that Tommy Thompson might get in. I was like, oh God, please not Tommy Thompson again. I mean, Tommy, it's the 90s are over, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And Tommy's a big government Republican. He's no hardcore conservative. And I think at his age, he's just more looking for a legacy and likes to go along to get along and be liked. And, you know, he was interim chancellor of the University of Wisconsin system and, you know, was big on the mask mandates and the COVID vaccine mandates. And he just, I don't know, Tommy Thompson is not a conservative dude. If he was at one point, I mean, he never really was, but he certainly isn't anymore. So thank goodness he's not running. So here's what's interesting is Diane Henricks, who's one of the state's billionaires and a big Republican donor, word had it that Becky Clefish was kind of her girl and that she was supporting Rebecca Clefish. But I've been surprised how even amongst people I talk to, because I've never been a Rebecca Clefish fan, she's as establishment gets. She's a reason that we wouldn't get stuff through. That's my opinion. But yet we've got so many people that I consider her the front runner that seem to think, like I talked to some a couple that I'm very close to in Delavan, my neighbor and his wife that lived next to where I grew up in Delavan, near my parents' house. And they're pretty, I'd call them pretty follow the leader Republicans, and I don't mean that in an insulting way, but they were kind of on the Leah Vukmir bandwagon when Leah Vukmir was running and against Kevin Nicholson in that Republican primary for Senate back in 2018. But even they said, yeah, we met Rebecca Clefish at some Republican events, in Lake Geneva or something, one of the Lake Geneva, Walworth County Republican Party cruises on Lake Geneva. And they said there was something about her that just rubbed in the wrong way. So, and that's what she does. Like Rebecca Clefish rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And I think this is starting to, I think some of their, whatever it's internal polling or something that was showing that Clefish couldn't beat Tony Evers. And so it's just been interesting. Like Rebecca really couldn't close the deal. And so now some of Rebecca's supporters, some of her big donors, like I think Diane Henricks was the one that was encouraging Tommy Thompson or Tim Michaels to get in the race. Of course, Tim Michaels now is getting in the race, is running for governor. Tim Michaels, big road builder, the Michaels Corporation's big part of the road building lobby here. And I don't know a lot about Tim Michaels, but I know enough to think that I was high on Tim Rantham. I like Kevin Nicholson, but I don't see Tim Rantham getting the traction that he needs. It's clear that Trump, and I initially miscalculated thinking that Trump was going to come out and endorse Tim Rantham right away, which would vault him very far forward in the Republican primary field. But then you realize what Trump's tactic is certainly Trump's endorsement does carry a huge, huge, huge bump in support. Some say as much as 30 points in a Republican primary. But Trump also likes to pick the winners. So I don't think Trump likes putting it, it's clear that Trump doesn't like throwing his support behind people who haven't established themselves as, I think in a close race, getting close to the end of a campaign, Trump would swoop in and drop an endorsement to bump his preferred candidate over another. But early in a race, when you got a guy like Tim Rantham, who I guess you could say hasn't yet proven he's a viable candidate, I think Trump's really waiting for someone to prove themselves as a viable candidate before he offers an endorsement. Because, again, Trump, yes, he wants to get his guys, his people in. But at the same point, he knows that while he can give someone a big bump, he doesn't have the Midas touch. And just because he endorses someone doesn't mean that that person is going to win against all odds. They still have to be have established and proven themselves to be a viable candidate. And some of that might just be that Trump wants to get a pulse of the people of a state to see where a candidate is percolating up and how a candidate is doing. But it's clear to me, Rebecca Clefish was clearly everybody's front runner. And of course they made a big show about how she went down and met with Trump. But I think if Trump wanted to endorse and solidify, because with Becky Clefish being everybody's supposed front runner, with Becky Clefish being everybody's supposed you know, the inside track. I think if Trump wanted to support Becky Clefish, he could have endorsed her already, because I think she had that enough of a proven front runner-ish status that his endorsement could have sealed it up for her, could have ended the race and really pushed it solidly to Clefish's favor. So I think there's a reason he didn't. I think there's a reason Trump isn't comfortable endorsing Clefish. And I think he's hoping that one of the other candidates, as the campaign moves on, proves themselves, demonstrates themselves to be a formidable challenge. And then I think that Trump may come in and offer an endorsement. It's hard for me to see Trump offering an endorsement for Clefish, because he could have already done it, and it would have made sense to already do it if it was going to be her. Tim Michaels, I mean, we'll just see where his campaign goes. Kevin Nicholson, I think that might be someone that Trump might be interested in endorsing, but maybe is just, again, waiting, because Kevin is a little bit of an outsider, doesn't have an established electoral record, and maybe Trump's just waiting to see if he can get enough traction to be a formidable candidate, close enough to where the Trump endorsement can put. Because like I said, if there's a Republican and it's a 70-30 split, you know, 70% of people were voting for Clefish and Nicholson had 30% support, you know, Trump might say, hey, I can give Nicholson a big bump, but it's probably not enough to get him over the hump. I'm not going to go and endorse someone who's might not win or wouldn't be a pretty likely win. On the other hand, if he comes out and the polling says that it's 50-50 Nicholson and Clefishy, I could see Trump coming in and offering an endorsement to push Nicholson over the top. And I would presume that Nicholson is probably a more preferred candidate than Rebecca Clefishy would be. And again, Tim Michaels kind of the wild card here. No one seems to really have a good perspective on how Tim is going to place in this field. But so it'll be interesting to see where this thing shakes out. It's interesting to see talk radio trying to handicap the race. And it's so funny, because even though they're saying, well, they're not like, I haven't heard anybody. I haven't heard Dan O'Donnell. I haven't heard Vicki McKenna. I haven't heard Mark Belling offer an endorsement for anybody or say that one's their preferred candidate yet. But then Dan O'Donnell does say some stuff that I think is unfairly biased. Like he'll say, yeah, it seems pretty clear that Kevin Nicholson was his first choice was Senate. And again, I think that's an unfair statement to make. That's pushing Dan's conclusion onto people. And again, my conclusion was, I think Kevin Nicholson he's committed to getting involved in politics to make a difference. And I think he wants to make a difference in the biggest place. He wants to make the biggest impact that he can. If Ron Johnson wasn't running for reelection, we would all be begging Kevin Nicholson to run for Senate, because he'd be a very good candidate for that. He's run in the past. On the other hand, I think we would all agree, and I think Kevin Nicholson agrees, that Ron Johnson has done such a fantastic job that if Ron wants to run again, that he's the best person to run. And then I mentioned this at the Wisconsin Carrier annual meeting today. Some people sit there and they say, oh, well, he just wanted to be a senator. No, I think Nicholson would have rather been governor and would rather be governor. I mean, governor is a more powerful position than senator. A senator, you're one of 100. And a governor, you're one of 50. A senator is just a legislator. A governor is a chief executive. If Kevin has higher aspirations for higher public office, I think there's a much larger, a much clearer path to the presidency. And again, Joe Biden and Barack Obama notwithstanding, usually governors are more formidable presidential candidates than senators. Barack Obama was an exception to that rule, and then so was Joe Biden. Of course, we all know Joe Biden didn't win, but take Ronald Reagan, former governor. I mean, you take a lot of the governor is a more clear path to presidency than senator. And so Kevin Nicholson has young kids, school age, not high school, school age. Would Kevin rather be in D.C. all the time or in Madison, where he could probably be with his family? His family might even live with him in Madison, or maybe they would stay in Pewaukee, but he would certainly be seeing them frequently. I think he'd rather be in Madison. So when people say that Kevin really wanted – the knock on Kevin is that he really wanted to be senator. And then Dan O'Donnell keeps repeating that. And I think that's a disservice to the candidates. I think it's a disservice to Dan O'Donnell's role on his show is to sit here and keep portraying this, which is Dan's conclusion, but again, it's not mine. And is it the right one? Again, I don't think so. I think if you want to look at it from a negative standpoint, oh yeah, he just wanted to be senator and consolation prize is running for governor. No, I think that he wanted to make a big impact, and he's not going to run for a state office, not going to run for assembly, not going to run for state Senate. But I think didn't want to run for the U.S. House of Representatives, but senator or governor was where he was going to make his entrance into the political world. And with those two potential offices, two potential campaigns that he would want to wage, I do think that he would be more happy, more preferred governor. Though if Ron Johnson hadn't run, that would have been the more convenient campaign to run, the more needed campaign to run, the more important campaign to run. If we had given that there's other Republican / hopefully conservative candidates already running for governor. So anyway, that's just, it's been interesting to listen to talk radio, sit there and try to handicap that race. And it just, again, it frustrates me because I think they're poisoning the well a little bit when they make comments like that about, and they say that, there's pros and cons of all the candidates, and they don't come out and, like they were in 2018, really bashing Kevin Nicholson. They're not doing that. But I think projecting these assumptions that they've made onto other people is kind of a disservice. And that's what I see Dan O'Donnell doing when he's projecting the notion that Kevin Nicholson really wanted to run for Senate and governors are a consolation prize. I don't think that's a fair assessment. And, but it's one that if he keeps pushing, I think some people will probably buy into because he keeps pushing it instead of letting people make their own conclusions or whatnot. But so let's see what else to, just got a couple minutes left here. So I think I'll talk about, so my daughter, Kayla, again, she's my fiance's daughter, but I call her my daughter because that's how I refer to them and how I see them. I don't have daughters of my own. Like I tell them, I'm not their only dad, but they're my only daughters. So my fiance's daughter's Kayla Julia. Kayla is in college. She's going to University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, though I convinced her for a number of reasons that she should start at the Waukesha campus, because the Waukesha campus is a shorter commute. And certainly I wasn't a big fan of having my 18-year-old daughter, who's now 19, but at the time 18-year-old daughter, driving downtown Milwaukee every day or three times a week or four times a week or whatever, just with the crime that's proliferating downtown Milwaukee and not to mention just the wasted time and the commute and all that stuff. For me, I really am glad that she chose to take my advice and go to the Waukesha campus. But what we're experiencing, she's got an English class. And in this English class, her teacher wants her to write an essay, a 10-page essay. And he's essentially, I should read it to you. I don't know if I still have it, but it's essentially pushing students. Maybe I'll do that. I could do a longer topic on this. Maybe I'll save this one for next week because I could go give you the back. So I was going to give you the short version, but maybe I'll save this one for next week and I'll do the more in-depth because I have the assignment as he gave it to them. And I wanted to read that to you guys because I think it'd be an eye-opener for you. So maybe I'll do that when I talk about the topic she's going to do, because she wanted to do a topic on gun rights and self-defense. And it's interesting to see how the professor tried to steer her to a certain angle on that, being the liberal that he is. And Again, just an interesting topic. So I think I'll save that for next week and do a larger one. And then there was one other thing I was going to talk about this week, and this is this whole new ghost gun thing. You know, now you're hearing ghost guns talked about all on the news. And the comments that I want to make on this is to offer my opinion, my expert opinion, if I could be so bold, is to say that this whole ghost gun conversation is a trap. this notion, and some people are trying to, you have to understand that you have to understand your enemy, understand your opponent, whether it's a sporting contest or political. The notion that Democrats, I hear people when they talk about ghost guns, and I've seen this on the Wisconsin Carry MeWe page, and they say, I'd like to know how many crimes are really committed with ghost guns. I suspect it's very, very few. And again, on its face, that might be true. On its face, that is a plausible theory that these ghost guns aren't the problem that the media is making them out to be. But it plays into the notion that gun control and crime are related. And it plays into the notion that Democrats are genuine in trying to address crime. And when I think this is a mistake that pro-gun folks make, is they think that when Democrats propose, they think the reason that Democrats propose gun control is because they think it'll reduce crime. And I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again and again and again and again. Elected Democrats are well aware that gun control is not going to stop crime. When they propose gun control under the guise of a solution to crime, it's a pure distraction. It's a pure snow job, because what Democrats are really most concerned about is not criminals with guns. It's law-abiding citizens with guns. It's you. It's me. Democrats think that the greatest threat to this country is extremists, is right-wing extremists and militias who could, mount another insurrection like they think January 6th was. So when sometimes I hear pro-gun folks trying to counter the Democrat proposals for gun control with logic and reason about why they wouldn't stop crime or why they're and I'm here to say that is the wrong conversation to have because you need to understand that what really needs to happen is we need to expose the big picture, because the big picture is elected Democrats, the people writing these laws, they're well aware that it's not going to stop crime, not going to affect crime. They're ultimate goal is to get guns out of the hands of the law-abiding citizens. Universal background checks are being proposed and being pushed not because Democrats, and again, there's Democrat voters who are dumb and they'll just believe whatever the Democrat politicians tell them. But your high-level Democrat politicians, your high-level Democrat leadership who sets the agenda, who sets these strategies, their strategy is not to, they could care less about crime. I mean, maybe they care a little bit, but they know that universal background checks is going to give them a registry of all of the law-abiding gun owners. They know that a thug on 35th and Valit who currently buys a gun, who's already a convicted felon, is buying a gun illegally, isn't going to go voluntarily submit to a background check at a gun store in order to transact a gun sale. They're going to keep doing the same thing they're doing right now, which is buying a gun that they're not allowed to own from someone who's not allowed to sell it to them, who are both well aware that they're committing a felony in what they're doing. So when we as pro-gun folks, or when pro-gun folks try to counter the messaging, so when we say, oh no, ghost guns don't aren't responsible for crime, we really need to take a more exposing view and say, they're trying to prohibit law-abiding citizens from building their own firearms, which is the way that a lot of, you guys know, you've seen it online, how many tons and tons of people are, building their own ARs and that kind of thing. Those are the guns. And those are the guns that the Democrats want to be able to trace guns, not back to criminals, but back to you, the law abiding. Those are the ones that they're most concerned about. And those are the ones that that's the target of gun control. Universal background checks is aimed at reducing the flow of guns and documenting what law abiding citizens have guns. Trying to ban ghost guns, trying to ban people from being able to build guns. That's not intended to stop crime. That's intended to stop the law-abiding citizens from amassing larger amounts of firearms in their collections and in their resources. So, yeah, all those things, we need to play offense, not play defense. Instead of sitting here responding, because you're not fighting the right battle. When you sit there and say, oh no, ghost guns aren't used in that many crimes, well, first off, maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but so what if a ghost gun was used in every crime? So what if every crime was committed by a ghost gun? Because if you say, well, ghost guns aren't used in many crimes, it's not that big of an issue, well, maybe someday they will be. Maybe, because especially when, you want to know why AR-15s are... let me stop this music because I was going to hit the exit there. But if you want to know why so many AR-15s are used in crimes and mass shootings, it's because the media makes such a big deal about AR-15s that everybody who doesn't know much about guns thinks if you want to go commit a mass shooting, an AR-15 is a gun you got to get to do it. Little do they know, if you'd go get a shotgun loaded with buckshot, you'd be much, much more deadly in a large crowd situation than an AR-15 would be with a little .223 caliber bullet. But so with all this talk on the news about ghost guns, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. Oh, ghost guns, ghost guns, ghost guns. You can easily build a gun from parts and no background checks and blah, blah, blah. And yeah, it's very likely that then a lot of thugs might start to acquire their guns by building them themselves through the parts. And again, I don't know because I've never done it. Because I think some, I don't know if it's the lower receiver, if you do, because if you buy that from a, I don't know the process well enough to know, and maybe I should educate myself on it a little bit. Anybody who's listening here, send me an email. If you're very familiar with building and what parts of the gun, because for some reason I thought that the lower is what has the serial number on it, on an AR-15. And so that's the actual one that needs to be transferred. But I don't know if you can buy a lower without a serial number or how that works. But in any case, what we really need to, instead of trying to persuade, instead of trying to defend, instead of trying to dismiss the proposals to regulate, quote, ghost guns, because they're not used in very many crimes. Again, it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy. It could be that more criminals start to, and again, a ghost gun, guns that don't have serial numbers. I mean, what's the difference if it's built without a serial number or if you grind the serial number off? Either way, it has no serial number. I don't think criminals even bother grinding serial numbers off their guns because the gun can't be traced back to them anyway because they stole it or they bought it illegally. So it can't be traced back to them. So this notion that, I mean, that thugs care that they want to have a gun without a serial number. I don't even think that's the case. No one that's going to commit a crime with their gun goes and buys it in a gun store so it can be directly traced to them. And then it's the whole thing is silly, but that's why we need to expose the real motivation here and say, hey, look, this won't stop crime. But the real goal here is to stop the law-abiding, and that's something that should be concerning to everybody. This would have zero effect on the criminals and a huge effect on the law-abiding. And, oh, by the way, we're all well aware that it's the law-abiding that these proposals are aimed at getting guns out of the hands of. It's trying to reduce the the hobby of building firearms that so many law-abiding citizens are engaged in. That's what this is about. This is not about crime. This is about the law-abiding, and that's what we need to push when we have these conversations about, quote, ghost guns, when we have these conversations about any kind of gun control, is to go right at what the Democrat goals really are. And that's, the goals are really to get guns out of the hands of the law-abiding, not stop crime. And we need to expose that for what it is. So anyway, that's the show for today. I put this on last minute and didn't have any live listeners here in the chat. If there was people listening live, I wasn't aware because they didn't log into the chat. But you guys listening to the podcast, thanks for tuning in. Hope you guys have a great week. And we'll see what comes up next weekend. Maybe we have a show, maybe we don't. But I'm going to for sure try to be at least bi-weekly with the podcast. Again, I was bad this past time. I think I went 3 weeks without one, or 2 weeks, excuse me, 2 weeks in a row without one. And I'll try to at least be weekly or bi-weekly. So you guys have a great week. Stay free, carry on, and be well armed.
This is Sniper Chick Julie. You've been listening to Well Armed Radio, and I have to know, is that a gun in your pants, or did you just really enjoy the show?
Stop listening to the bombastic loudmouths on the radio and television and the internet. To hell with them.